I write, quipped novelist Flannery O'Connor, because I don't know what I think until I read what I say. This is the After Dinner Scholar from Wyoming Catholic College, and I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. There's another saying that's similar to Flannery's words. Thoughts are formed as they pass out the lips or through the fingertips. That is, speaking and writing gives clarity and precision to our thinking. And so at Wyoming Catholic College, our students not only read the great books, but they discuss them and they write about them. Our freshmen quickly discover that good discussion skills and good writing skills are not innate. They need to be learned and require study and diligent practice. This semester, Dr. Jason Baxter has been working with our freshmen as they improve their writing skills. Dr. Baxter, while I suspect that our listeners can fill in their own answer to this question, why, from your point of view, is it so important for our students to learn to write well?
I think we live in the age of Facebook and Google and hypertext reading, as Nicholas Carr calls it. And we have developed habits of skimming and discounting things such that we merely derive the opinion from something. But in terms of how it's qualified, in terms of any sort of subtlety or nuance, I think we've really dulled our minds by means of our flaccid, flabby reading. And so I think first and foremost, writing is this attempt to kind of arrest this slide toward this, what Orwell feared, of a kind of utopian world in which we have lost all adjectives and lost all qualification and lost all subtlety and lost all nuance. And we just have opinions with which we bludgeon each other and shout at each other. This is some sort of attempt, I think, to create a linguistic world by means of writing, and thus to be able to think into an argument, to consider its consequences, to reconnect truth to goodness and beauty. So, yeah, I suppose this class has lots of metaphysical pretensions masking as a writing class.
Well, it's to get people to think beyond a Twitter post.
Yeah, exactly, which is effectively reducing people to just, I don't know, kind of like circuitry on a computer, right? You send a shock and the individual circuit either blocks it or continues to transmit it, right? That's the sort of the depth of our discourse these days is, how do you respond to this opinion? Do I like it, or is it stupid, stupid, stupid? And I want to get beyond that of actually developing the powers for careful qualification, for subtlety, what I've called elsewhere, fugal thinking. That is, thinking like Bach writes, holding in mind not one opinion at a time, but 17 different truths, which are counterbalanced like a grand, elaborate clock.
Now, some might say that the ability to write well, particularly to write like a fugue, is innate. I mean, T.S. Eliot, C.S. Lewis, G.K. Chesterton, Glenn Arbery, Jason Baxter, you know, these are people who just have it. They're gifted, they're capable. Is that the case, or can kind of anybody learn to write?
I'm so glad you asked that. Yeah, it's the kind of the myth of romantic genius. You're either good at it or you're not. You're either Mozart and you're playing the piano at 3 to entertain countesses, or you're garbage. I think so. I think you know, when we think in the same way in terms of painting or in terms of drawing, that look, you either pick up your pencil and do something genius or you're garbage. But the reality is those skills can be trained. And the same thing with writing. And so in fact, this is one of my favorite things to do. I've done this at least 4 dozen times. Hopefully it's not too tedious to the students. I begin trying to trick them into giving me a certain type of answer. I say, isn't it unfortunate that some of us are just naturally creative and others of us are not naturally creative? And those who are creative are good at writing, and those who are not creative are not good at writing. That's really the case, isn't it? And at least I have a 65% success rate of convincing students. They start sadly nodding their head, like, yeah, that's right. Until one student says, wait a minute, isn't that the whole purpose of the topics of invention? To which I respond, surprised, what do you mean? You mean there's an ancient thought technology that helps non-creative people become creative called the topics of invention? And then of course, we can list them out, the definition, circumstance, relationship, testimony, and comparison. Almost forgot it there. But then we list them out and then sort of practice it using those things. But yes, there is an ancient form of, you could call it a thought technology. There's a method, there's a system, a methodology by which the ancients would sort of coach people in bringing out innate talent and that way very different from a kind of 19th century romantic genius model.
Could you tease that out a little more? How did they do that? Or how do you do that?
Well, I tell the students that, you know, you could think of writing in three different stages. The first is what I call a creativity or word cloud stage. It's when you sit down and come up with as many interesting observations. I say your goal is to come up with an abundance of creative ideas and observations and arguments and cool things to note. So many that you couldn't put them all in the same essay, even if you wanted to. That's more or less what the ancients call invention. And they came up with these things called topics of invention in order to help you test, expand, stretch your observations. So say that you had an interesting observation about a text or about your experience. The students right now are writing these nature writing essays in imitation of Annie Dillard and Gretel Ehrlich and John Muir and Edward Abbey, some of the great naturalist writers in America. They're writing about their own reflections. And all of them had at least one cool, breathtaking, awe-inspiring moment on their 21-day backpacking trip. So take that moment and just pause over it for a minute. Well, then if you think about that through the topics of invention, for example, circumstance. Circumstance just simply asks the question of the main thesis statement, how often does this occur? Is this a common occurrence? Is this a rare occurrence? Is this a once-in-a-lifetime occurrence? Is this an impossible occurrence? If you start asking questions like that, then something that you've experienced, you could say, well, this is a once-in-a-lifetime experience. Then you can move on to one of the other topics of invention, like relationship, which is one of the chief relationship is cause and effect. What is the cause which gave me this unique insight for the first time in my life? Why was it that never before I ever had this unique insight? How did modern culture come about, cause and effect? How did modern culture come about so that we don't even know that we're supposed to have this type of insight? If you just start sort of cycling through these types of questions, you're slowly generating a whole network and web of connections. This is invention or word cloud thinking or creativity. The ancients then think that, I always say, imagine all your cool observations like a series of stars in the sky. Arrangement, the second stage of writing, or what I like to call is finding deep patterns within your observations. It's finding the order to your argument. I use a metaphor and say, it's finding the constellations which connects the stars. Well, the ancients have methods for coaching and how to do this as well, how to find these sort of deep structures, these deep patterns inherent within your various observations. Then you take some of these, your coolest observations, your arguments, your proofs, your expansions, and then just write about those and how they're connected. Now you have an essay, you have something worth saying. The final step is to go through and what the ancients call style, which I sort of loosely translate as the ability to craft language, which is precise, succinct, and beautiful, so that it's moving and memorable. Or to quote Lewis's book review of Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, if you need to write in such a way that the reader feels, here are beauties which cut like swords and burn like cold iron. Then as I tell my students, you don't have to worry about persuading your readers. You can leave that to Providence. What you do have to do is write in the sort of way that when you're in, even if your interlocutor disagrees with you, he or she will wish that what you said were true. I myself am not a believer, but the way that you write about God, I really wish for the first time that there were. And I think that's what style is. So I think thinking about these three different things, the ancients have what I'm jokingly calling this ancient thought technology, in which you're sort of coached to develop your own thoughts, to organize your own thoughts, and then to make them succinct and precise and even sharp and memorable, to use schemes and tropes, these sort of this linguistic word art, to release the inner emotion of language.
Now, what authors do you encourage students to read, or what authors have you read to improve your writing, and what do they teach us?
Right, so I think one of the chief goals of this class is that at some point each student will adopt an author and say to himself or herself, I need to read every single word that he or she wrote. I think there's some great prose stylists. I've encouraged students to look to more modern authors. Newman, for example, is commonly praised as a great prose stylist, but he writes in something which we would probably now call the high style, which seems to us professorial and pedantic, and it's extremely complicated. It's very what the rhetoricians would call hypotactic. He writes like Cicero or writes like Dickens with lots of subordinating conjunctions, and the syntax is quite difficult. So I encourage students to look for good prose stylists who write in a middle style, which tends toward the low and seems honest and down to earth. So Wendell Berry, C.S. Lewis's nonfiction, his essays, his sermons are great. I think Belloc and Chesterton are great, but they're right in the middle style, which tends to the high, as opposed to a middle style, which tends to the low. I love Gretel Ehrlich. I love Wendell Berry. I just read with the students the other day his essay called Damage, this three-page, very memorable essay. I think Edward Abbey is a cool, interesting naturalist writer. I'm interested in the modern English writer Paul Kingsnorth, who just wrote a piece in First Things about his conversion from essentially eco-environmentalism to Christianity. I think he's a great writer. So I'm going to introduce the students to about a dozen different prose stylists, and we read them together, and I say, okay, use your vocabulary from your study of classical rhetoric and tell me why this modern writer writes in such a hauntingly effective way.
Mm-hmm. My wife picked up a book of essays by E.B. White when we were in Maine. And he, what a marvelous writer.
He is a great writer. His introduction to his editing of his old writing teacher's book, the so-called Strunk and White, The introduction is really delightful. There's a particular passage in which, I think it's Roman numeral 8, I just read it four times with my classes, in which he has this hilarious description of his old writing teacher in the 19-teens teaching his students to omit needless words. And E.B. White reflects on this and what it means to try to make every word and every sentence tell. That you go back and read your essay one sentence at a time and say, does every word tell? Could I replace some of these words with other better words? Are there junk words? Is there sort of driftwood that can just be completely removed? And at first, the students are kind of afraid of this because they think that their papers will go on a keto diet and just shrink up to nothing, and they won't be able to hit their word counts. But then when they realize the power of this, that they're able to, you know, essentially give 5 pages of information and 2.5 pages of prose, they realize the sort of power of this. And I think that's, E.B. White's really good at that and writes in a funny and memorable way about that in his introduction to Strunk and White.
I'll have to reread that. Are there any student success stories you can share real quickly?
I will know very soon. We're just entering into fall break and I've received all of the student natural writing essays. I'm going to grade them. I'm going to choose the 4 best or the 10 best ones and let an anonymous judge or a judge read them anonymously and then select the down to 4. Those 4 essays will then be performed publicly in front of the freshman class, and we'll have a People's Choice Award and inaugurate for eternal glory the greatest freshman writer. So that will all be happening within the next 2 weeks. So I should have a lot more information soon. But I would say right now the great success of the class is that the students groan and yearn to write well. I've tried to contextualize this class with reference to what one scholar, Deborah Lupton, calls the datafication of the selves. That is, as we increasingly allow technological and computerized algorithmic formulas to control our thoughts and even our feelings and our relationships, the need for writing, which is an organic process, becomes all the stronger. And I think the students have seen this. And so I would say about half of my class is kind of having a something of a spiritual and intellectual crisis in the best possible way, wishing that they were good writers, wishing that they could reach down into their hearts and say something which was profound and moving and sharp and precise. And I tell them that they should be really happy about that, to come face to face with their own lack of ability and to long for something greater is the first stage in any real educational process.
Before the start of my senior year at college, yea, those many years ago, I needed some minor surgery. At a follow-up appointment just before heading back to school, my surgeon asked me what I was majoring in. Philosophy, I answered. Philosophy? He responded in disbelief. Why in the world would anybody major in philosophy? Well, I replied, it's teaching me to read carefully, to discuss ideas thoughtfully, to reason soundly, and to write well. I'm not sure, I continued, what more I could hope for from a liberal arts education. That managed to convince my doctor that philosophy was a good major, and I'm a bit more convinced every day. A liberal arts education is a wonderful gift. Careful reading, thoughtful discussion, the demand for sound reasoning, and learning to write well are precisely what a Wyoming Catholic college education offers students. It's a wonderful gift. So let the high school students in your life know that it's here to be received. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tomkowicz.